A movie, which we have made a tradition in this committee of watching from time to time to expose our knowledge and appreciation of natural resources, is a movie called Cry of the Marsh. Actually, there are two movies. One is a short movie called Cry of the Marsh, and then there was a follow-up to it called Echoes of Cry of the Marsh. And we are honored also to have the owner of the land where this film was made, Bob Hartkopf, who is going to share a few words with us as well. So we're really, really pleased to have him. So these are these two bills, Senate File 2533 and 2588, are related to one another. So we have both the authors at the table. Senator, no particular order, but Senator Bach, would you like to start explaining the bill? And maybe Senator Anderson, you could explain your bill, and then we can have Mr. Meyer and Ms. Erickson come up afterwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2533 is a bill that does two things. It relates to the creation of the Lake Vermilion State Park, the U.S. Steel land that's been in the news and been a subject around here for a couple of years. When the bonding was put in place in the 2008 bonding bill, there was $20 million put in place for acquisition and development of the Vermilion State Park. When the state and the governor and the state reached a final agreement with U.S. Steel, there was a provision in that bonding language that said they couldn't pay more than 12% over the state's appraisal. And because the price that was reached, the agreement reached of $18 million, doesn't meet that provision. It's more than 12% over the state's price. What the bill proposes to do is waive that requirement, that 12% requirement, so that the state could pay up to $18 million for the land in the park. And so it doesn't appropriate money. It just changes the percentage of the $20 million in bond proceeds that can be used for the purchase. The second thing it does is currently there's the Sudan Underground Mine State Park on Lake Vermilion, and now there's the new Lake Vermilion State Park. They're contiguous. They share the same boundary. So I thought it would make sense to put both parks under one park system rather than create another new state park. So we'd have the same number of state parks because Sudan and Vermilion would become one park. I think that's an efficiency issue. It's the same road access coming in there right now. I wouldn't want to be in a position where we create another whole management of another park structure when they have a contiguous boundary. It seems from efficiency matters, it would make more sense to run it as one park. And I think that's actually how the department is planning on doing it anyway. I just want it to be clear that I don't want to, as much as I'd like the jobs up in my district in St. Louis County, I think creating a whole nother park infrastructure of people puts an additional stress on the general fund that we don't have money to fund today. So under this provision, the number of state parks in the state would not change. A Sudan would just be incorporated into the Vermilion State Park and they'd be run as one.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
That's about all that's in it, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Anderson.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting us both present the bills today. I think it's a good sign that we have a lot of strong support in the Senate for moving this proposal forward, so I'm really glad that we both are presenting bills today in support of the new Vermilion State Park. And, you know, I think we should start by saying that we've been hearing about this park for several years. Many of you have had an opportunity to go up and view the land that we're talking about for sale, and I hope if you haven't, you know, we get a chance to do that again. We did take our committee up there when? A year ago, November, I guess. So about just over a year ago, and there was a lot of snow on the ground, and it was below zero, so we didn't get out and explore very much. But I think we all know that it's an incredibly beautiful part of the state, and we have an opportunity to create a real legacy by creating a new state park on Lake Vermilion. So I'm very excited about that opportunity. And it's been interesting to see the reaction in my district, which is right down here in St. Paul, And I have had constituents more, excuse me, more passionate about this issue than many others for this legislative session. I've had constituents come up and corner me and say, are you going to get that state park built? Please get that state park approved. Get it done. It's really important to me. So people really care about this, and I think people all around the state are very excited about the chance to set land aside and preserve it for future generations. And as we all know, it's been rather contentious over the last year or so, negotiations with U.S. Steel. And so I think we need to seize this opportunity to move forward and acquire this land before it's developed, because it would be a prime development spot. Just to remind members, and you probably all know this, but the legislature already appropriated $20 million in bonding authority for the purchase, and it was also intended for the development cost of Vermilion State Park in a previous session, so that the money is already available. And the difference is that the price tag now that we're looking to pay is $18 million, and so it would leave only $2 million left in bonding authority to start the development process. And so we're not talking about adding anything to our bonding bill. We're not talking about adding anything to our deficit. We're talking about money that's already been authorized. And the only question really in front of us is, should we lift that cap? And there's really two differences between my bill and Senator Bach's bill. One is that I just eliminate the cap from state law. Senator Bach makes an exception. Those are two sort of very technical differences, different approaches. I think, actually, I like the approach of just repealing it, because the cap was put in place just for this purpose, and so we might as well declutter the statute books and just take it out. I think Senator Bach has a really good idea about trying to merge the two parks, and I'm really interested in pursuing that as well. And I think we should have some more discussion about that and whether it actually would save us some money in the park system, which would be a great thing. So we can approve this, and I think that we should approve it. And one interesting thing that I've learned in this process is that when there are appraisals of land for the purpose of evaluating whether the state should buy them, that appraisal information is all required by law to be private data. And so we're not able to get access to really detailed information about the appraisal. So it puts us at a little bit of a disadvantage. And, of course, we pass the laws, but that's how we've set it up. But under the data practices law, that's the situation. And so we're kind of we're at a little bit of a disadvantage here. But I think it's very important for us to do our due diligence about this expenditure, even though I'm very excited about the opportunity of buying this park and saving it from development and putting it out there for the public to use in perpetuity. So we've sort of heard inklings that the state appraisal was in the mid-teens somewhere, low $13, $14 million range, and we know that U.S. Steel has believes that the value of the land is over $20 million, it's about $20 million. I think that if you divide it up into lakeshore lots, this land, and sold it to people who want to put up multimillion-dollar homes, you probably could increase that appraisal amount quite a bit. And so I think there's a broad range of possibility of what the land could actually be worth. So I think it's incumbent upon us to be responsible with those dollars. But I think, you know, it's sort of a cliche to say that this land is priceless for future generations. So that's why I decided I wanted to speak out in support of it and introduce this legislation. The last thing I wanted to say is that we do need to consider some of the fiscal implications of this proposal, and I'd like these bills to go to the Finance Committee, and then we can talk some more about it. Senator Bach is also on my finance division, and we can figure out there what to do about merging the bills. We need to talk about what are the costs of development of this park and how will we incorporate them into it so that the park does move forward, but it doesn't undermine other state parks. We need to make sure we talk about that and have a plan that's that's appropriate and fair and will make this park available for public use as soon as possible. And we also need to, there's a special PILT law that applies to this acquisition, which is on the books already. And so we just need to take a look at the financial implications of this. So I'd like to do that in the Finance Committee. So with that, members, I guess I would appreciate it if you could send both these bills forward today, and then we'll continue the discussion.
Has there been any discussion since we appropriated $20 million and this Senator Box bills for up to 18? Is it the DNR's intent to put the money back or send the money back or release those? I can't remember what it's called, release the bonds or cancel the bonds? Or because Senator Anderson mentioned something about some of that money was supposed to be, I can't remember which one of you said, some of it was for the development. Is there a plan for using the spare $2 million to put into developing the land? Does either of you have any idea on what's...
Mr. Chairman, I think we probably should hear from the department what their thought is on that. But I can tell you what my vision would be, considering I think I'm the only one of the eight range legislators that support this. The other members of the delegation and my county commissioners are very concerned that this is just another land grab in the north, that the legislature is going to appropriate the money, we're going to buy the land, and there's never going to be a park there. So I am asking you that if you think this is a good idea, there's a second piece to this, and it's appropriating $30 to $40 million more. This is 3,000 acres of very rugged terrain to actually build the state-of-the-art park, I think, that I hope we build there someday. And I expect there'll be a proposal to do that in the form of bonding coming forward at some point. My support really is contingent upon this becoming a park, not just taking more land off the tax rolls, because there is, in St. Louis County, the commissioners have a legitimate concern. About 61% of the county is publicly owned. And so there is my county commissioners have a very legitimate issue about taking another $20 million of property off of the tax rolls, and my support of this kind of runs contrary to my no net loss of tax capacity that I have argued around this place since I was elected in 1994. But I have seen how Lake Vermilion has changed. I grew up on the lake, and when I was 11 years old, I got a little used three-horse motor for my birthday. We had a little 14-foot steel boat, and I felt like I owned Wakama Bay on that lake with that little three-horse motor. And there were a lot of little cabins all over the lake and a lot of families that could enjoy the lake. And how it has changed from the 60s when I grew up there is amazing. And now the cabins aren't $50,000 anymore. In fact, they're building one about half a mile down the shore from me that's going to be between $10 and $12 million. There's an incredible amount of very expensive development happening on the lake, and my concern is that the public needs to have an opportunity to use the lake in the future by use of more than just a boat landing, which we have. So opportunities, and I'll just tell you, my thought of this is a very, very multi-use park with a whole diverse array of camping opportunities, be they RV hookups, very primitive camping with tents, or primitive camper-type cabins that people will be able to use. I envision an opportunity for people that want a more primitive experience to be able to paddle or motor out to some of the islands. There are 365 islands on Lake Vermilion, and quite a bit of public land on them, that there should be an opportunity with remote camping picnic type sites out there for people that could be included in that park experience. I just think there's some tremendous opportunity for the public in the future, but only if somewhere in the future somebody appropriates the rest of the money. And so I'm really kind of rolling the dice with my support of this, that my colleagues in the future, whether I'm here or not, are going to do the second part of this and actually make the kind of park that I think will be a destination in the Midwest. Yeah. Like the Gitche-Gami Trail on the North Shore that I've been working on for a number of years. I think both of them have the opportunity to be huge tourism amenities in the Midwestern states.
Senator Fredrickson and Kielash.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach I want to talk about a little different aspect of this bill. I agree with your bill to combine the management of Sudan Underground Mine and the new Lake Vermilion State Park. My concern is losing the identity of the Sudan Underground Mine. There have been a generation or more of people that have visited that. It is absolutely a unique park in Minnesota and maybe in the nation. And I would like to see somehow the name of that Sudan Underground Park incorporated within the Vermilion State Park, or if it would be the Vermilion and Sudan State Park, or Vermilion and Underground Mine State Park, partly for marketing reasons for the state park system, but also so that that part of our heritage, of most directly your heritage in northern Minnesota, is not lost.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, to your point, I agree with you. I would envision this having a very large, and this is why I want them to run as one park. I envision a very large interpretive center that is jointly run by our state park system and the Historical Society, much like the Split Rock Lighthouse State Park is now. Part of that is funded by the Minnesota Historical Society and part funded by the state park system. And I would envision the same kind of facility here, where the Historical Society would run the state parks, or the Sudan Underground Mine part of it, and then the Division of Parks would work with them, much like we do at Split Rock.
Senator
Bach, that's an interesting idea. I had not considered the Historical Society operating the underground mine. That would be a way to give both visibility. I suspect the Historical Society. Does the Historical Society have a role in that underground mine? No, it's been a while since I toured it. I don't recall.
I don't know what their role might be, but I don't believe it's part of the budget. I don't believe they actually spend any money on it. But to what extent some of the artifacts really are cared for by the Historical Society in conjunction with the state park system, I don't know. But I do think it would be a very good joint facility, much like Split Rock.
Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach and Senator Anderson, I'm just wondering, is there a portion of the funding for establishing the park available through the legacy funds?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, I mean, we've appropriated the legacy funds for 2 years now. So for the remainder of this biennium, it has been appropriated, and it's, you know, there's a portion that went to the DNR for state parks. And so, again, we could ask the DNR to speak to the budget allocation for those dollars, and if they would see, I mean, it's going to take a big chunk of money, as Senator Bach said, to get the park up and running. A smaller chunk to get it up and running so people can at least get in the door, drive in, you know, park, put up, you know, whatever. But to be able to really develop it fully is going to be more than is available in the current budget through the legacy funds. But over the long term, that's certainly got to be part of the discussion.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, what I was wondering is it eligible for that legacy funding to develop it? And realizing that the legacy funds lasting another 23 years or whatever, and it, what part of the legacy funds would be able to be invested in that park, if that's possible. So,
Senator Kielash, the short answer to your question is at least the parks portion of the legacy funds would be squarely eligible for use under this. And then depending on what other specific activities go on within the new park, the other portions could be available. For example, if there was a effort in some of the park to restore, protect, and enhance some part of the park, and you know, the project lined up could be available for the outdoor heritage. If there was a effort to clean up the water in some way, shape, or form, it could be eligible for the clean water portion. So yes, it's. I think the door is open for discussion on using the funds, depending on a particular activity.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, by the way, the arts, too. The arts and culture portion of it could also help.
There's history involved in
absolutely.
It as well. So, I mean.
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, just to perk the committee's interest, if there's ever a diamond strike in Minnesota, it's likely to happen under this park. They have been exploring for a long time the idea that the rock formation is of the nature that could hold diamonds. But it clearly will be an underground thing because it's much like the Sedan mine was, because it's very deep. But there are a lot of people who think there's a diamond strike either under it or very close to it around Sedan.
Actually, as we've found out more recently, there's even a chance of an even more important strike, and that is actually to answer some of our theories of the universe in the Sedan mine with some of these...
dark matter.
Dark matter, yeah, dark matter particles. So that is fascinating. And,
Mr. Chairman,
it's really unique place. First place in the world where
Mr. Chairman, when I went to the, I guess they called it a groundbreaking of the cavern that the University of Minnesota was going to create underground there, there were scientists, this was a number of years ago, there were scientists from all over the world there. That were anticipating research being done there relative to the origin of the universe. And I will always remember the editor of one of my newspapers was there, and the scientists got up and talked about all the things they're going to study there. And the editor of the newspaper said, you know, when you find out whatever it is you want to know, what are you going to do with that information? And the scientists said, we don't know. But there is some pretty amazing research going on in the old Sedan underground mine as we speak.
It's interesting. Can I just wax a little philosophical here? You're kind of marrying two parks together in this bill. And in the Hindu tradition of marriage, there is a portion of the ceremony where where the woman there's a red dye put down the center of her, where her part is. That is always made out of vermilion.
Well, it's red.
Mm-hmm. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, mine's going to just be more or less a statement. This is a state park. It's my park. It isn't just up where Senator Bach lives. My constituents go up there. I love to go up there. And I watched Lake Chautauqua when I grew up on Lake Chautauqua. I could ride my bicycle on any piece of that. I could go on anybody's dock. Do you know what, today I can't do that. Even as a senator, I can't do that. Because it's all private. They've got big fancy homes on there, which is fine. The biggest base in Murray County tax base is a lake property. So, you know, I'm glad that you're moving this forward. We cannot lose this. Somebody will come in and develop that, and then we'll say a few years from now, oh, my gosh, how'd that ever happen? So I'm with you 100%. I would hope we can move it quickly. And the one thing I would say, you better fix that mine a little bit, because that's a little shaky getting up and down that.
That ancient elevator.
Mr. Meyer, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you to Senators Anderson and Bach for helping us move this language forward and for all of the support that has been brought up today. I think many of you have been up to this piece of the country. If not, we will look at ways to get you up there once the snow melts a little bit so you can refresh yourself with the piece of property we're talking about. I just wanted to review a couple things, the questions that came up dealing with the original appropriation of $20 million. That original appropriation was for acquisition and development. It's our intent not to cancel any of those bonds, but to use the remaining $2 million to provide some primitive... We want people to be able to access this property as soon as possible. So to do that, we need to begin and expedite the master planning process. There was a task force that was formed 2 years ago, made up of local citizens, groups, state groups, that talked about the potential uses and how this property should or could be developed. That information will be fed into our master planning process, which by law in Chapter 86A says we have to have a master plan done before we can actually do any development work. So we're going to get that done. We want to put in some primitive pit toilets, some trails, do some road work. So people can, it's our goal, we hopefully to have people doing some day use activities within this park if we can get the acquisition done as early as next fall if possible. So we want to use the remainder of those dollars to begin and start doing that work. The rest of the work that would be done, people refer to a comment that Director Cortland Nelson made for $30 million. It's going to cost $30 million. And actually, some people say the commissioner said that, but it was Cortland's or Director Nelson's vision of what possibly could be done and what he thought it would be. But if we were given $30 million, it would take us 5-10 years at least to expend those funds. So once the master plan is done, once we have a plan laid out, we have to do cultural significance work. We have to do some geological work, water mapping, make sure that we know where we can put roads, where roads and trails should be. We will be coming back with a systematic approach to get the park developed the way that people view it as being. It probably won't be one lump sum, but several bonding cycles worth of funding to help us get the work, the park done and developed as soon as possible.
But you don't need $2 million to set up some overnight campsites, do you? And some maps for use?
Maybe. Mr. Chair, members, I have a broken-down budget. About $500,000 would be for preliminary work that would be done, design and engineering. About $500,000 for the pit toilet work and everything else that would be done, trails. And road work is, in this part of the state, is going to be complex and somewhat expensive. So, and the roads are several miles long. So I can lay out a budget. I think we'll talk about that more in the Finance Committee and what those dollars would actually be used for and realistically how much they would be. So it's our intention that the $2 million would get us started, but we'll need more to move forward.
I understand some of the road stuff and then the visitor center and all that will cost far more beyond that. But for the next committee, could you explain, and I'm going to get questions from my constituents, why we need to spend $500,000 on toilets? That must be quite a few, or they're really, really nice, one of the two, or both. So I think we're going to need some details on that. You don't have to answer now, just to prepare for some of those questions.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure who wants to answer this. Maybe Commissioner Meyer can, but how many state parks do we have, and how does that compare to Wisconsin, I don't know who else you'd compare it to, Illinois. Do you know how many we have and how many we compare it to some of our neighboring states? I would think that's probably South Dakota, North Dakota doesn't have very many of them. But.
Mr. Chair, members, I believe we have 66 state parks currently, 7 state rec areas. I couldn't tell you exact numbers of what the other states have, and I don't know if I mean, we can find that out. We have a lot more. Certainly than a lot of other states do. I know if Iowa, for example, doesn't have as many parks as we do. Wisconsin may have, but not to the caliber or the extent that we have. Well, I can get that information for you. We can answer that question.
Follow up.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Erickson is whispering. She thinks they're fairly comparable, but we can let her maybe address that better than I can.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, actually, I believe the number is in the high 60s, even actually low 70s in Minnesota. One of the questions, Senator Anderson's bill here, maybe to understand this a little better. Now, we're going to be paying more because of the 12% above appraised value is going to be taken out of the state statute. So is that what that means? We're going to actually be paying more for this property than we normally have been paying for property in the state of Minnesota by this bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator, that's a really good question, and I'm sorry if I didn't make that clear. We put this cap into place specifically for the purchase of this park. And so we haven't, as far as I know, I don't know what the normal rule of thumb is for how much you can pay above appraised value.
10%? I'm informed by council it's around 10%.
So we put this in just for this park acquisition, and the DNR went out and did a state appraisal. And as I said, you know, we haven't been able to get, public information about it, but what we've kind of heard is it's somewhere, in the $13, $14 million appraised range that in the state's appraisal. I don't know if I'm even supposed to say that, but anyway. And obviously the seller, U.S. Steel, hasn't been willing to sell at 12% over that. And so we've been sort of stuck in a stalemate for over a year here. And so I think what we're asking today and for the Senate and the House to pass these bills is to agree
that we're willing to say that we are willing to pay more in this case. And I think part of that answer is that I'm not quite so sure what the appraised value of that land really should be, because the seller is confident that their appraisal is correct, and it's quite a bit higher. And I think, you know, with land values the way they've been fluctuating recently, there's probably a lot of range in what the appraisal would be depending on when you did it. And I think depending on what assumptions you use about whether you assume it as one parcel or whether you assume it as development parcels.
Right.
And so to me, I mean, if you really sit down and do the math on the, I mean, I think they were talking about doing 48 kind of luxury lake lots. And if you do the math on that, I think $20 million is a pretty reasonable price for, what is it, 5 miles of shoreline, 4 or 5 miles of shoreline on one of the most beautiful lakes in Minnesota, plus several thousand acres to boot. So honestly, I think the price is fair, and I think we should pay it because it's priceless. It's a priceless piece of property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree. I don't necessarily agree with the purchase, but I agree with your figuring in. Should and as Senator Bach all explained as well, you start parceling them off into some beautiful lake home properties, and they're certainly going to be, it's going to be worth a lot more than what we're talking about here. And then that's where my concern comes in, and I think Senator Bach conveyed that as well, as the county boards and the townships are looking at this as another land grab and another loss of revenue for them. So with this inflated price, and again, it's not inflated. I understand that. I understand it's a beautiful thing. There's no question about it. But in paying, you know, over the appraised value, Senator Bach, maybe you know this, pill payment's always been near and dear to your heart, as it is to all of us. What's going to be the difference here, do you think? Or can you even come close to that on per acre pill payment versus private payment?
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingritson, the pill payment will be nowhere near, even the enhanced pill payment in law for this will be nowhere near what the property would generate in property taxes once it's fully developed. I think what the question is how many years before it's fully developed? You know, we're in a pretty weak real estate market right now. Land values on Vermilion have not gone down. In fact, I think land values on none of our lakes probably have gone down. I think they've quit going up. It's kind of what's happened. But there's about 27,000 feet of lakeshore in this purchase. And you can kind of do the math. A piece of lakeshore on Vermilion that has road and power to it sells for about $2,000 a foot. So if you put $2,000 into $27,000, that's a lot of money. Who's got a calculator? You know, how much is it? 27,000 feet times 2,000 a foot.
54 million.
50-some million?
54 million.
But, you know, that all would assume you have to bring the roads in, you have to bring the power in, and it assumes an awful lot of development.
Right.
We're paying about $660 a foot for this property. You know, there's, I believe, 62 building lots on the lake shore, so that's around $300,000 a lot. I can tell you, for a 300-foot lot on Vermilion, $300,000 is a really good buy.
Well, building upon that,
so I don't, one thing, so I don't forget, this isn't the total purchase price, the $18 million you see. I believe there's an agreement with U.S. Steel that they're going to be able to use a $2 million gift to the state for the to get them up to their $20 million appraisal. You know, I mean, the CEO of U.S. Steel has a fiduciary responsibility to his shareholders to get the appraised price. So I believe what they've agreed to is $18 million in cash. And then the state would allow them to take a $2 million gift to the state for tax purposes.
Ah. So building upon that even more, Senator Bach.
It'll be a federal tax.
If we are
action, not a state one. Is it? We're not paying for that.
Well, they pay up.
If the state of Minnesota is buying this property for over 12% over the appraised value, let's just say it's around 15%, plus another $2 million, wouldn't it be, what does that do to the surrounding comparables, even though knowing that it's for state park purposes, but wouldn't it be a benefit, an added benefit for this purchase, that surrounding the surrounding market could now look at some comparables of 15%, maybe more, above appraisal value? And so private sales, which are being hurt by really low appraisals, could somehow benefit.
Well, Mr. Chairman, at $660 a foot, I mean, comparables are based on lakes are compared on the lot size. Mm-hmm. At $660 a foot, I would argue that this would reduce valuations on other undeveloped property.
Mr. Chair, I've been looking for a lake lot for a couple of years, just sort of casually around the state. I haven't gone as far north as Vermilion, but I can tell you that $300,000 for these lots is a steal. And so I don't think that it's 15% over appraisal. I think it depends on how you do the appraisal. And I think it's like Senator Ingebrigtsen said, I think the price is a fair price.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've sort of become convinced of that. The comparables don't take into account these important factors. They're often very simplistic, and they just look at the price. They wouldn't look at, well, that's the price, but it was 15, maybe 20% over appraisal.
Well, Mr. Chairman, on that issue of appraisals, there is no state appraisal. There's only a state appraisal if the state gets an appraisal and then they certify it as the appraisal, and that was never done. So there really, and the department can correct that, but there really is not a state appraisal that has ever been certified that the state received one. And the reason for that was if the state had done that, it would have triggered that 12% requirement. And there's just more going on than what everybody can see.
Mr. Knopf, does Senator Bach's bill repeal 365, Section 25?
Mr. Chairman, what Senator Bach's bill does is it overrides both Chapter 365, Section 25 from 2008, and the general law that precludes the commissioner from acquiring land from paying more than 10% above the appraised value. So what it does is basically says whatever laws that are out there, this one, the statutory requirement, notwithstanding those, that they can pay up to $18 million for it. So it kind of basically says ignore those laws. This is the later law that's passing. The DNR can spend this much money to acquire the land. What Senator Anderson's bill does is take out the 12% but leaves in the override for the general law on the 10%, because that 84.0272 that you see on line 1.8 of Senator Anderson's bill, Subdivision 1, that's the general requirement for purchasing land where the commissioner can acquire land for up to 10% over appraised value, but then the commissioner then also has to acquire land for less than appraised value to make up the difference. The state always has to be in an equal foot. I mean, if the commissioner acquires something for 10% over, you have to find an equal amount of land that it can acquire for 10% below, and the general rule.
So, Senator Bach, is that your intent to repeal the 10% general law as well?
Mr. Chairman, for this project, the intent is to override both the 12% provision and the general provision in law.
Okay.
For this purchase, I agree with the idea of having a cap on what the state can pay. I mean, I represent the North Shore of Lake Superior, and the state owns a lot of land on the North Shore. And one of the first issues that came in front of me after I was elected in 1994 was an acquisition on the Baptism River on the North Shore, and the property owner wanted way more than the state appraisal. That cap is a good idea to try and kind of make sure that the state isn't taken advantage of in purchases. So My intent is to just override it for this one purchase.
Mr. Knopf, that's what this does, just overrides it for this purpose?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Now, the other question I had is, you'd mentioned, Mr. Meyer had mentioned that part of the purchase is a $2 million gift. But Section 20, and in Section 25, it specifically authorized acquisition by gift. Does that, does your override of this section, Senator Bach, then, or maybe Mr. Knopf can answer, does that hinder that portion of the purchase, Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, you can have Mr. Knopf answer the question as well.
Mr. Chairman, no. It basically, the commissioner has the ability to acquire land by gift or purchase just in general. The commissioner has general authority to do that. So it doesn't even, they didn't even really need to have this provision on 1.7 of the law from 2008, except for that they were going to try to override some things in that law. It was the only reason that they put that in there.
And then this, for this project, it would take away the requirement that the land be appraised as well?
It does not take away that requirement. It does require that. It says except for the it's basically, it's notwithstanding the section I mentioned earlier that requires them to or prohibits them from acquiring anything that is greater than 10% over the estimated value. But this does say except for the requirement that lands be appraised. So it does require that the lands be appraised. That is a current requirement in statute, and that would not, that is not overridden by what was passed in 2008.
Is it overridden by Senate File 2533?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Other questions? Senator Stumpf, you haven't had a chance yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Meyer, what will this, and I know it's hard to kind of think ahead and know what all goes into State Park and what the reaction to the public will be and the usage and stuff, but is it your intent that this park would make money?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, we would hope so. It's the vision of that this park will be similar to Itasca, some of the other big parks that we have in the state. So, yes, I think this park would generate revenue, not only for the state but a lot for the local area as well. There's going to be, as Senator Bach and Senator Anderson spoke of, we envision a lot of different type of uses, primitive, modern, on-lake facilities, on-island facilities. So we feel that this will be a very popular state park.
Senator
thank you. The other question relates back to a previous question that was asked. I'm not sure who's the right person is to ask this question of, but if the apart from the bonding, you know, the development, I guess, the money that goes into the development of the park, would this development, why couldn't this development be funded out of the revenues from the sales tax, the extra revenues out of the sales tax?
Senator Stumpf, we talked about this issue a little bit earlier when Senator Kelosh asked the same question.
Correct.
Some of it could be eligible.
And Mr. Chairman, is it because of the the sequence-wise? When will there be revenues available under that for that haven't been allocated for some purpose?
The general answer to your question would be next year.
Okay, thank you,
right. Senator Dibble. And then we need to get on to the movie. Are there burning questions? I think we're pretty good on information on this project. Senator Dibble?
Just more information. People are curious how many state parks we have. We have 66 state parks.
Right.
6 state recreation areas, 8 state waysides, most up on Highway 61, 19 state trails, and 54 state forest campgrounds and day use areas. So that's what we've got in our inventory.
Ms. Erickson, did you really have anything that you needed to add that we need to know?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Judy Erickson, and I'm with the Parks and Trails Council. And normally I would say no, but we did ask our board of directors to take action on this item over the weekend because we were going to talk about it tomorrow night. So in light of the fact that our organization and my board members took some time this weekend to look at this, I did want to speak in favor of moving the legislation along to remove the caps so that we can proceed with the acquisition of this property. It's a beautiful piece of property. It's a place that all Minnesotans should be able to enjoy, and not just those wealthy folks who can afford one of those a home up there. And so we do really think it's a very important step forward. And Minnesota has always been a leader in state parks, and the opportunity we have today continues that tradition.
Thank you very much. Senator Anderson, would you like to move both bills?
Sure, Mr. Chair, and as I said, I think at this point we really haven't had a chance to sit down and compare the language with the department and figure out which is the best approach, if it makes a big difference. So I think I would ask the committee if they'd be willing to move Senate file. Well, I think we have to vote on them one at a time on both bills forward at this time. So I'd move that Senate file 2588 be recommended to pass, and then Senator Bach could move his bill, I guess.
I'm not a member of the committee.
Senator
Anderson,
you're
not a member of the committee. I apologize. I will move both bills. That's what you were asking me. That's why you asked me that. And Senate file, what's your number again?
Senator Anderson moved that Senate file 2588 and Senate file 2533 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Kielash?
Just a question. Doesn't Senator Anderson's bill, isn't that incorporated into Senator Bach's bill already so that it's not really necessary to have this repealing?
Senator Kielash, Senator Anderson's bill repeals less than what Senator Bach's bill does, so there is a slight difference.
It's not a repeal on his. It's
discussion on the motion. Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Heitkopf, would you approach the table?
Yeah.
Well,
come off.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll have to double check. So we'll make sure we do it
right
way.
Good.
Oh, yeah.
What's
I'm sure it's part of the castles out. Someone needs to get on the TV to get it ready.
Yes.
That would be the most beautiful thing in the world. I don't care. But we are the leader already, and we're buying more. We don't have the money to buy anything.
Mr. Harkoff, we've got copies. We're passing them out. We're passing them out for you. Go ahead and take a seat at the witness chair. Could you step around and sit at the witness chair, please?
There's not going to be a serene. Right. You could have tons and tons more votes. The first section of both bills are really a stylistic.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of which one government is the largest.
Mr. Harkoff, welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself and give us like a two-minute background on what we're doing. And then maybe at the end, hopefully we'll have time, we could come back up and members could ask you questions.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm so happy that you're interested in water. Senator Bach talking about his background is sort of the same background I had, with the exception that I grew up on the edge of a beautiful marsh rather than Lake Vermilion. So that's how Cry of the Marsh evolved. I grew up on this beautiful marsh. It was drained in the late 60s. In fact, they tried to drain it in 1910 unsuccessfully. But the big machines were big enough to do the job right in the late 60s. So it was drained in 1960. I tried to stop it, hired a lawyer the whole bit, wasn't able to. So I decided at that time one of the few things I could do would be to document it. So I bum-bowed and almost stole film equipment to film the destruction of the marsh. The result of that was a confrontation with the bulldozers and the drag lines, and finally I came up with a little 12-minute film, which came out in 1970, the first Earth Day. That's Cry of the Marsh. Now, a little background on Echoes of Cry of the Marsh. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the University of Minnesota Morris decided to do a follow-up film, video, DVD, which you'll see today, related to Cry of the Marsh. So they, in conjunction, came up with Echoes of Cry of the Marsh, which you'll also see. And as Senator Chaudhry said, I'll be happy to answer any questions if we have time afterwards. And I'm hoping each of you will get two handouts, one for Cry of the Marsh and one for Echoes of Cry of the Marsh. And without further ado, if we're
Chairman, could I ask one
in a position to go, can we get the lights or do we need to get the lights?
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hartkopf, could I ask you one question? What county is this in?
Good question. I was going to mention that and forgot. It's in Swift County. The marsh is about, the drain marsh is about 7 or 8 miles northwest of Appleton, Minnesota.
Okay, thank you.
And this was your property?
Part of it was. There are 7 landowners, including myself, 4 of which now have some sort of governmental program, and they would be willing to restore it to a marsh. It's almost 1,000 acres, so there are 7 landowners, 4 are already in governmental programs and would restore it to a marsh. There are 3 holdouts. So my emphasis through the years has been restore this beautiful thing. Wetlands, rivers, and lakes are all interrelated. We've gone to the point of destroying 90% of the marshes in many counties in west central Minnesota. So I've been on a mission since the late 60s, and I still haven't given up. I'm still hanging in there.
All right, go ahead and start the movie. So we're going to watch 2 movies, one a short film, 12 minutes, and then a follow-up that was done by the University of Minnesota Morris, both on the same topic.
Thank you. Thank you. Is provided by the University of Minnesota Morris, the Upper Minnesota River Watershed District, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Ducks and geese, Canada geese, mallards, a whole variety of duck species and other geese as well. The flight of a goose or a duck has always inspired me. I love to see in birds. I think they were attached to that lake for their survival and lived in the lake. As a kid, I realized that that was their home. But this old farmhouse was my home.
For more than 70 years, Bob Hartkopf has walked the grounds of his family's farm in Swift County, Minnesota. As a young boy, Hartkopf wandered through the shallow wetland that grew beside his father's crops. The wetland was called Mud Lake, an ironic name that failed to describe its beauty and wildlife. But when it came to crops and springtime floods, Mud Lake seemed a more apt description in the minds of local farmers. Hartkopf, on the other hand, saw Mud Lake as a classroom. He studied the plant life and the migration patterns of local waterfowl. The education inspired him to become a high school science teacher. However, the farm Hartkopf sees today does not resemble the farm he knew as a child.
People at that time did not farm fence row to fence row. There were little nooks and crannies on the farm, little wild weed patches. Cornfields had lots more vegetation in them, and that, in fact, led to more wildlife.
Hartkopf was not alone in seeing the changes in the Minnesota landscape.
My dad was a great local historian in that he knew there were big stories in small places. And we would drive by these areas that at one time you'd say, you know, there used to be a lake out there. And so we'd look out there and imagine what that lake might have looked like when there was nothing but corn or soybeans growing there.
Wetland that's destroyed the biodiversity just goes to zero. It becomes a biological desert when it chucks in corn, soybean, or whatever, if it's farmed, which means you virtually have no wildlife.
As the 20th century progressed, attitudes about wetlands changed dramatically. The government initiated policy to help increase the amount of food American farmers could produce. Wetlands became the enemy.
If removing water gets me more, pretty hard to have another discussion if that discussion is on the surface.
I was devastated. You know, it's just like losing one of my closest friends or family members when this marsh was drained.
Hartkopf decided he could not stand by and let these wetlands disappear into history. So in 1959, he picked up a 16-millimeter camera and began documenting the ditching work near the family farm.
I remember Bob indirectly from my days in college, and was fairly impressed with the, very impressed the first time I saw the film they produced, Cry of the Marsh, and remembered it. It made a lasting impression on me.
And I thought it was so remarkable that something that had a, I think, a pretty significant impact on me in high school was coming back to me so much later in my career. As I started to learn more and more about Bob's story of what amounts to a 35-year odyssey to restore that one particular wetland, I couldn't help but start to share his passion for its restoration, I guess.
Hartkopf's film touched off a debate that still rages today. To drain or not to drain, that is the question. And it's a difficult one to answer in Minnesota and other states dominated by agriculture. For most of the 1960s and 70s, the mighty industry of crop production took front stage.
Farming throughout centuries in Minnesota has been like that. Just the God-given right to do what you want with your own property.
In recent years, sentiment about wetlands and farming has changed. The public has begun to understand the value of restoring wetlands,
and the great social cost of industrial fence row to fence row farming. Within this debate, many people stand between extremes. Conservationists call for protection of wetlands, while farmers try to maintain a profitable farm. Politicians and the public are left to decide where to find the middle.
When it's somebody else's property upstream, we're all in favor of ducks, and we think we're ecologists upstream. But as soon as the water touches our land, we become engineers, and we want to send that water downstream as fast as we can. So we want the guy upstream to dam and fill his land up with lily pads and natural grasses, and everything will hold the water. But as soon as that water gets close to us, we want pumps, we want diversion channels, we want ditching.
And we saw a case a number of years ago where a fellow really drained what was called a lake and just put it on a neighbor. And so he improved probably 30 acres of his own land, but he probably ruined 25 acres of another farmer's land.
What are we doing here? We've got one arm of the government paying farmers to behave poorly. We have another arm of government paying farmers to try to correct the problems that are created over here. That's just craziness.
Hartkopf and others think the time has come to make serious changes in farm policy. The disappearance of wetlands from Minnesota has made a negative impact on our environment and affected our quality of life.
The ecosystem deteriorates immediately. The water's gone. Once the water's gone, usually the dry marsh bed is burned off, which is the case in this case. The marsh bed was burned, and no wildlife, period. The wildlife's gone.
The consequence of draining these small depressions into ditches that flow to main stem rivers is that we have more frequent flooding, and we have more severe flooding than we ever had in the past.
Hartkopf continues his quest to see wetlands restored on his family farm, but neighboring farmers continue to drain their plots, which drains Hartkopf's land as well. Though that may seem unfair, by federal, state, and county statutes, it's completely legal. Hartkopf's quest has become a symbol for the larger debate about finding a balance for our environment, a balance between industrial profits and a healthy ecosystem.
It's an ongoing debate, and it's not an easy one to stop. Not an easy one to stop. Because when they're paying big production costs, they need big yields.
You can take a thread out of a quilt, and one thread, you may not notice it, but you start plucking threads out, and pretty soon you look at it one day, and now you've got a big hole in it, and it's not the same beautiful thing that you once enjoyed and you received from your grandparents a generation ago.
You know, humans wouldn't think of going into the Museum of Natural History and destroying it, burning it down to the ground. But yet, we go into a marsh which is many times more beautiful than a museum, with all these living species, for the entire countryside to observe, without having to pay a fee to go in to look at dead specimens in a museum, and we destroy it. I can't buy that, and I can't stop from working on the restoration of a living, biodiverse, beautiful system.
During the age of glaciers, the fertile fields of Minnesota were covered beneath a thick carapace of ice.
Over several thousand years, that ice would melt and it would leave a depression, and that depression fills with water today. That's a wetland. Many parts of the Prairie Pothole region, historically, the density of these wetlands was as much as 100 per square mile in some of the densest areas. We may be the land of 10,000 lakes, but we were once the land of 10 million wetlands.
This landscape remained unchanged for the first 100 years of our country's history. However, in the middle 1800s, water and wetlands became a central issue for pioneers attempting to settle in Minnesota.
A society that can't bring water in will perish, and a society that can't push water out will perish. So the manipulation of water is not a choice once you've reached a level of complex society. In fact, you can't have a complex society on any other condition rather than manipulating waters. Water
is a cost. I mean, to get rid of it or bring it, it's a cost. It will cost you labor or it will cost you machinery.
For the earliest farmers, wetlands, especially those shallow wetlands, made farming unpredictable and risky.
Farmers' acreage rose and fell with the water levels, actually. And a lot of farmers decided, well, if we can hay these sloughs off in dry years, why can't we drain them and use them all the time?
My mother and I were told at the time that we would never have to fertilize that land. It would grow all these crops for years and years and years. And all that happened was that every time we had a excessive rain, it would flood our crops out. And it made no sense to do what they did back in those days.
But those early Minnesota farmers were ingenious and exceptionally hardworking. It didn't take long before they discovered that draining wetlands could turn the cost of water into an investment.
When the farmers were out here, why not get rid of the wetlands? More farms, lower prices, more land, get rid of the mosquitoes. You can drive your cart from one place to another without having to go around or without getting stuck. There is every reason you'd want to get rid of water at that point, and the government was fully behind it.
Minnesota was just a new state, and in 1860, they were included in the Swamplands Act. I think they got jurisdiction over about 5 million acres of land to drain, and a lot of that was agricultural land. And so those state projects started in the 1860s. They didn't really develop a good water policy or drainage policy until about 1887. Bull ditchers came around, and they were essentially teams, men that owned these large teams of oxen. And the only way that they had to drain some of these smaller wetlands was to dig a ditch and drain them out. And so they'd have teams of 10 to 15 oxen attached to a huge, almost like a moldboard plow, and that plow would just simply dig a ditch from the wetland out to the nearest outlet, which would be a creek.
Draining wetlands required years of incredible effort, but the work enabled farmers to create a stable life out on the rugged prairie. The wetland that bordered on the Hartkopf farm was known as Mud Lake. It flooded every spring with rain and snow melt. It was poor land for growing crops, but that didn't keep his neighbors from trying to drain it. It was a decision that confronted many families across Minnesota. Drain a shallow wetland and increase your farmland and possibly your profit.
As we progressed and got larger machinery and things, that what we started out with, that 12 and 14 acre fields, now all of a sudden became a real hindrance to that farming, because we all like to have a full 160 acres that we can drive from one end to the other. And all those things encourage drainage.
In the early 1900s, the bull ditchers became steam ditchers, and the rate of drainage across Minnesota increased exponentially as machine technology advanced. Though draining wetlands was a relatively new event on the Minnesota frontier, sportsmen immediately noticed the effect.
They would spend days out hunting, and they often were the ones who were protesting. They were the ones who saw an environmental impact of losing these wetlands, that they were going to be losing hunting land, they were going to be losing places where their families could swim and picnic. And they often led the charge, like today.
Despite these early protests, the push to maximize crop production had just too much momentum. After the World Wars, the U.S. government saw agriculture as a means for shoring up the country's food supply and securing America's place in global politics.
America was now being perceived as the entity that was going to feed the world. And so there was a big incentive to put the latest and greatest technology into the hands of farmers. And one of the things they used it for was increased drainage of wetlands.
Most of our ditches in Minnesota were created prior to 1940. Let's see, by 1940, 45, we had about 27,000 miles of ditch in Minnesota. But we were also tiling, farm tiling was becoming more and more efficient, so we were tiling more and more water into those ditches.
You're going to be prone to find tiling with farmers who have excess capital for investment, because it does cost money. We're going to tend to have flatter land. And we're going to be in counties where the ditch systems are more articulated, probably in most cases, because then they can feed the tiling into those systems.
Then we start to see flooding, possibly. We start to see watersheds jumping their banks and going into other watersheds.
By the 1970s, the landscape of Minnesota had been completely changed.
If you're sitting in southwest Minnesota or northern Iowa, you're probably looking at wetland drainage rates that exceed 90-95%. That means fewer than 10% of your natural wetlands remain, and there are many watersheds where there are no small depressional wetlands left.
American agriculture had entered the modern age. Maintaining high production meant using every possible acre. This also meant less time and fewer resources farmers could devote to keeping their land clean.
In order to farm huge acreages, you know, they need huge machines. They don't have time to do the recycling, so they have to put in chemical inputs, fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. So to me, we've lost that close connection that the earlier farmers had with the land. And today, it's following the desires of the big corporations and their input. Wetlands are more productive on a per unit basis than an Iowa cornfield. 1 acre of wetland produces more in the form of plants and animals than does an acre of Iowa farmland. So people simply aren't accustomed to the idea that these wetlands are extremely valuable.
Wetlands are natural filters for nutrients like nitrates. When the nitrates flow into a wetland from the upland cropland that surrounds the wetland, the result is that they are lost to the atmosphere through a process called denitrification, so that the water that ultimately exits a wetland is cleaner than the water that entered.
As individuals, we need some connection to the natural world, and wetlands in Prairie out here are the two biggest communities that this area has.
Few would argue the value of agriculture to the state of Minnesota's economy. Many believe that wetlands stood in the way of future profits. But in today's age of superabundance, some are asking, what have we lost in exchange?
Being here in western Minnesota in the Prairie Pothole region, we have a particularly strong responsibility for migratory birds, and in particular waterfowl, trying to provide breeding habitat and migration habitat for waterfowl and other birds that depend on the prairie wetlands and the grasslands that once covered this entire area.
When the prairie pothole portion of North America is wet, two-thirds of the entire continent's duck production may come out of this small part of the continent. And in fact, it's the prairie pothole region that drives the pulse in duck numbers that we occasionally see. When the pothole region is wet, we see continental population spike. And when the pothole region is dry, we see the duck populations enter and persist in a long, slow decline.
Wetlands come in several forms, ranging in size from small marshes to small lakes. Generally, wetlands are classified into 4 groups. Temporary wetlands hold water from 1 week to 1 month during growing seasons and provide valuable food and nutrition to female waterfowl. Seasonal wetlands hold water up to 60 days during the growing season and feature ground cover for duck pairs to isolate themselves for breeding. Semi-permanent wetlands hold water in the spring and summer unless a drought persists. Ducklings are raised here amidst the brush and native grasses. Permanent wetlands are usually more than 6 feet deep and sometimes confused with small lakes. Mud Lake near Hartkopf's farm was classified as a semi-permanent and permanent wetland. Ducklings could hide in the bulrushes around the edge. But when Mud Lake was drained, the ducklings and other waterfowl simply disappeared.
A lot of people think they leave, you know, so what? They just move over to another marsh or whatever, which isn't the case at all, because the other marshes are occupied fully by other plants and animals. And they don't just leave and go to another marsh and exist there. They disappear. That group of wildlife simply disappears forevermore.
If you drain most of the small temporary wetlands that only hold water from 7 to at most 2 to 3 weeks during the growing season, you will eliminate most of your breeding population of ducks. They simply will not settle in this part of the state, this part of the continent.
It's just been in the last 20 years that we have realized that maybe it's a good idea that we replant some of these prairies, that we restore some of these wetlands, and not just for the diversity of wildlife and critters, but for the health of the landscape and for the health of the community.
They offer a buffering capacity to the land. The water from a heavy rainfall event or snow melt that would otherwise go and contribute to a flood in Montevideo or in Fargo or in St. Paul.
Flood damage reduction is one of the primary reasons that we restore wetlands today. And in fact, if you were to look at the Prairie Pajo region landscape at the time of European settlement, as little as 10 or 20% of the landscape may have actually contributed to river flow. Water ran off the land into the rivers. The other 80, 90% flowed into small depressions like these. Now, when you drain all of these small depressions into a main stem river, the result is predictable. You get much more frequent flooding and you get much more severe floods.
We'll have a 100-year flood event, and it seems like every 5 or 10 years we have a 100-year flood event. Well, part of that is because we've changed the equation. The land cannot hold the water because we've lost our wetlands. The land can't hold the water the way it once could.
Flood prevention is just one natural control that wetlands provide. They also filter pollutants to keep them from our rivers, lakes, and water tables.
Any pesticides that come in, herbicides that come into the marshlands are taken up by the plants, cattails and other plants, so that they don't get into the river systems like the Minnesota River or the Mississippi River.
Today, thousands of tons of farm chemicals from Minnesota leach into the Mississippi River, and they become a problem for our neighbors to the south.
We believe that that's a function of the runoff primarily of nitrogen fertilizers from the intensively farmed portions of the Mississippi River watershed. Ironically, the Minnesota River watershed here in southern Minnesota is one of the worst polluters in terms of total contribution of nitrogen to the problem associated with Gulf hypoxia, we believe.
Then all of a sudden, it looks like we cut water a cheap deal, so we sold it on the cheap. Now we've got to figure out how we can save what we can save or even put back what we can put back, because it's a long-term asset we need for other purposes.
I go to a lot of classrooms, and almost all the time the little kids will bring up, you know, and you got to love them. I mean, you know, they'll bring up the fact that, you know, the rainforest. And sometimes the teachers will even have posters or taking up collections or selling something or to protect the rainforest. And it just slays me is that we drained 95 to 99% of the prairie wetlands in Minnesota and across the Corn Belt. We destroyed and converted 99.9% of the native tall grass prairies out here. But yet we have the gall to teach our children that we should be scolding third world countries on clearing the rainforest. I mean, it just kills me.
50 years ago, ecology was a new term in the English language. Books from early conservationists such as Aldo Leopold and Rachel Carson inspired us to take a fresh look at the effects of modern farming on our ecosystem. Bob Hartkopf was one of the people who adopted this new perspective.
Well, the farm is an ecosystem, And the marsh is an ecosystem. And the marsh is tremendously diverse and rich. And farms can be tremendously diverse and rich. Except we have, through our operations on most farms today, reduced that richness to kind of a monotone production. We've got corn and soybeans.
Though he no longer lived on the family farm in Swift County, Hartkopf was determined to record the changes wrought by large-scale drainage, and he was determined to restore the rich variety of plant and animal life he knew in his youth. But as he would soon learn, his options were limited.
So we're seeing something that approaches the look of the early grasslands throughout North America, which is just a small, small remnant is left. You know, I think there's less than 5% of the early grasslands left. So what we're seeing are some of those original plants which dominated the prairie. My parents moved to this farm in the mid-20s, just prior to the Depression. And I was born in 1931 during the Depression. So it was a hardscrabble time for my parents, making a go of it here, as it was for all the farmers in this countryside. So as a young kid, I would go down in the marsh and bring back a few ducks or a few pheasants or whatever, and felt like I was really making quite a contribution to the survival of this farm. I remember my dad telling us that it's important not to over-harvest. You know, if you want a pheasant to eat, fine. If you want some venison, make a deer. But he always emphasized the fact that you don't want to over-harvest any of these animals. They have a part to play, and we simply need them. We just use what we can, and the natural reproduction will take care of itself to replenish them. Years ago, I used to see prairie chickens which migrated short distances. Years ago, I'd see prairie chicken flocks coming out of the north and passing over this marsh bed and passing over the farmyard. In fact, my brother shot a few prairie chickens that I can remember. So I was a part of the prairie chicken scene years and years ago. But they, of course, have been non-existent here for years in this area. Even as a kid at 5 or 6, I was continually drawn to the marsh, would go into the marsh, put on some boots, and grub around, looking at the plants and the animals, and got a real good sense for the ecology of that marsh at a very early age. I think my dad was ahead of his time in looking at the farm as a whole. I think he actually saw the farm, even though he didn't know what the term meant, I think he actually saw the farm as an ecosystem, and he believed in a healthy ecosystem and very much related to everything that was going on the farm, both domestic animals and wild animals. In those days of more diverse farms, people made a living by raising diverse crops and livestock. And you can say that the same thing happens in nature. The more diverse something is, the more stable something is. People would come with their horses and teams to an individual farm to fresh out the grain. So it was a lot more community oriented. And we all shared doing things together, spent a lot more time together. The initial drainage started in 1910, believe it or not, and that was done with a horse-drawn dredge. That enterprise was unsuccessful simply because they didn't have the big machines.
They didn't have big machines, but later they would. In the 1960s, old systems were lined with tile for faster drainage, and new systems tapped into old ones.
The when they did the job with these huge machines, they also used dynamite. So they would dynamite these trees along the ditch, some of which ended on the roof of our barn. I mean, you'd hear this huge dynamite blast, and part of a huge tree would land on the barn roof. It was like war.
I think his heart was broke when the marsh was actually drained. And I think he'd do anything and everything possible to see it restored. And he doesn't mean it to be against farmers or anything. He's doing it truly just because in his own heart that's what he wants to see done.
The more I thought about it, being I was virtually helpless to do anything about stopping the drainage, I thought the least I could do would be to expose it to a wide audience. The film was finally put together in the late 60s. And we decided at that time to hold it until 1970 for release. So it was released in the neighborhood, at least, of the first Earth Day. We entered a number of festivals. And it won awards in 6 or 8 festivals, including New York, Washington, D.C., Berlin. So it got a wide amount of coverage. It was shown on TV several places, and that got the film out there for the public to see. And I don't think a lot of people realized that that sort of thing was happening to the wildlife, and from the wildlife's perspective, you might say, I don't think they made the connection, really, until that time. I get some feedback every once in a while about a marsh being saved. But ironically, this marsh has not yet been saved. The one that I filmed being devastated. Well, the impact of Cry of the Marsh on my neighbors is largely unknown because I haven't really spoken to them about the film, and they haven't spoken to me about the film. But I'm sure they feel that what they're doing is more important than the marsh existing as a marsh.
When I first saw Cry of the Marsh, the film, it's just so sad because it's such a common story. It's a common tragedy that it's been repeated over and over and over again. Now, Bob was one of the few that took the time to document it and to do something about it, but it's a story that's been repeated thousands upon thousands upon thousands of times, and it's just inherently sad, I guess, to me.
I understand that people do have to make a living on a farm, and sometimes it's hard not to farm, even if it means destroying a wetland. But I think there are other ways of gaining income, and people are finding there are other ways of gaining income from a farm. And some of the farmers, of course, have a lot of land and probably could use a little diversity in their land as well. So if they're not struggling, it's hard for me to understand draining a marsh and destroying a beautiful, diverse ecosystem.
Since the earliest days of statehood, the right to drain wetlands has been protected by a set of laws that enable farmers to maximize crop production.
Current drainage law is an old law. It allows for one group, or sometimes, in some cases, if even an individual landowner has enough land in one particular area, to force a drainage or an improvement of or a restoration of a drainage system over another landowner or a group of landowners based on the amount of land they have in the system or the number of acres benefited land in a particular drainage system.
Through a legal drainage system, if you have several landowners that will be involved, and let's say only one or two people are for the project. What happens is if there's more than 50% of that land is owned by the individuals that want to put the tile in or the ditch system in, it is petitioned before the board or before the watershed district, and if you have that 50%, it has to be allowed.
That's the catch, you know, even though a number of farmers now have government programs in the lake bottom, there are two or three farmers left out of seven would still want to farm that land.
In actuality, I personally feel that probably our drainage laws have, like Minnesota drainage laws, have probably created a good deal of drainage, because farmers kind of get in a panic mood and saying, well, boy, I better get busy and get that drained, or they're not going to let me do it anymore.
Since the late 1960s, ditching and tonning permits in the state of Minnesota have been evaluated and issued by watershed districts. Watershed districts are primarily concerned with how farmland drainage affects flood control and water quality. Hartkopf's farm sits in the Upper Minnesota Watershed District. It is the largest drain basin in the entire district.
When a permit request comes in, we usually have to look at the entire area that they want to drain. We go through old photos starting back in the 1980s. We look for wetlands, possible wet spots that should not be drained. We do that first locally in the office. Then we go out on site with the farmer. He explains exactly where he wants his ditches to go, how much he wants to deepen them. So we do it really thorough with the farmers. The biggest dispute is always, I want to get rid of my water, but I don't want anybody else's, is the biggest dispute. And somebody, you know, cleans out a ditch and it runs down onto the neighbor, and that causes a battle.
Current law favors drainage, but farmers do have conservation options in the form of set-aside and buyback programs funded by federal and state governments. The Conservation Reserve Program, otherwise known as CRP, is a USDA program that pays farmers for up to 10 years in exchange for allowing a piece of land to return to its natural state. The Reinvest in Minnesota program, or RIM, enticed farmers to restore sensitive lands by offering payment up front and arranging a contract to determine the future use of that land. The Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, or CREP, took over where CRP ended. Under CREP, farmers agreed to take certain lands out of farm use permanently.
And when we enroll a wetland in a restoration program or in a protection program, we try to compensate that landowner appropriately, because we know its preservation does come at a cost to them.
I have several pieces of land in the RIM program, and I also have two filter strips along natural drainage ravines that are in the CREP program. And in my case, I've been very, very successful. I actually get more rent on that land than I do on the land that I rent out for farming.
My RIM acres down there don't look like it, but it's probably my highest priced land if I wanted to sell it, which I don't. But recreational land nowadays is an extremely lucrative chunk of property to have.
Under all three programs, CRP, CREP, and RIM, farmers are compensated relative to the crop capability of the land. However, despite the intentions of federal and state conservation programs, some farmers feel the payments and set-asides are not in their best interest.
It's kind of tough for me to tell my renter that I'm going to allow ponding on my land because I'm going to change my intakes to a different type of an intake, and he's paying me good money for this land.
The motivation for those individuals that no matter what hold out, it's more of an issue of government is what it comes down to. There are several farmers out there that just would do anything not to have the government have any say in their land, in their property. It's just a right that they feel like they should be able to make the decision themselves and nobody else.
The message is that this is a local issue. This is an issue of landowner rights. over the rights of maybe the greater public. That's still an issue today. I mean, that's still the idea that we can control what's going on our own land, no matter what anybody around us, how they might be affected.
Farming is more in the category of being a gambler. You borrow a bunch of money and invest in putting in the crop, and you hope that at the end that you get enough wage to come out in a profitable end. There's really no guarantees. You can take insurance and things like that, but probably that'll only be enough to say you broke even.
Risk, survival, history, resistance to change. Taken together, these worldly and human traits complicate our relationship to the land, and especially wetlands.
There's still a feeling on the part of farmers that if you take land out of agriculture, you're not allowing it its best use. That's still a real priority for farmers, is that you're not using that land. And by leaving it fallow, then you're wasting its potential.
Farmers are getting, as of today, prices for the crops that existed 40, 50 years ago, no higher. So it seems to me, by leaving a marsh, creating fewer surpluses, farmers will be getting more money for the crops.
We got evidence that we farmland available that we need right now, and technology has been more than able to keep up with the increase in demand. So, yeah, you're still buying a loaf of bread for a buck and a half. But production costs for a lot of these operators have gone a lot higher than proportionally than that.
Well, I think we've been sold a bill of goods. I think farmers simply have been sold the idea by these large corporations that in order to produce a crop, you have to use these things. You have to use these herbicides. You have to use these pesticides.
Farmers will do to the land what's profitable for them, what keeps their family fed, and what keeps their operation moving. The government policies dictate those things. But not just that. I think more and more corporations dictate how farmers are going to be able to farm their land as well.
We need to come together and sit down and say, we need to be smart about this. We need to raise food. We need wildlife. We need clean water. What can we do? Where can we go to find the right balance point for between wetland drainage and wetland restoration?
Do they appreciate seeing birds fly over the farmyard? Do they appreciate seeing a pheasant on the roadside? Do they appreciate seeing a buck deer in the marsh edge? If they appreciate diversity, I can't see how they can feel that the marsh is worthless. It would simply mean plugging up the outlet, plugging up the ditch, so the marsh would fill with water, and that would not take more than a year or two. Once the marsh is filled with water, some of the original vegetation, which is still in the soil, will begin to reestablish itself.
We know where these drained wetlands are. We know how to restore them. All we lack is the will as a society to decide how many of them we need to restore and where we're going to do that to benefit not only wildlife, but also clean up water and reduce flooding problems and things like that. And I think we have the technology to help us make informed decisions now so that we can pick and choose and say, if we're only going to restore 10 wetlands in this particular area, which 10 should we restore out of the 1,000 that might be there? We can pick and choose the ones that do the most environmental good, clean up the water the best, will raise the most ducks, will help other non-game birds, will help flood control.
By blaming farmers for things, you're putting the blame on 2% of the people. And the other 98% feel real good about themselves because the farmers are the ones that are guilty of all this.
Then we
all get the idea that I have a part to play in this. It probably won't get any better.
They're more than willing to listen. What they're really looking at is the bottom line, how they can make money off of a piece of ground that they have. They're not out to ruin anything. They're not out to destroy any part of the environment. What they're trying to do is make the land pay for itself.
My hope over the next 10 years is that we can work together smartly to figure out how we can meet the dual needs of agricultural production and conservation in this landscape.
It's not farmers that I have trouble with. It's the government that I have trouble with. Give me the right program. Give me the right program that makes sense, that pays farmers enough in order to make ends meet, and they will do what's right.
Several.
I think that kind of made the point at the end there, so we can end it there since our committee time is over. Mr. Hartkopf, any final comments?
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Hartkopf before we adjourn? Thank you very much for your patience, members, Mr. Hartkopf, for being here. That was an excellent movie. And I think you can want to see the rest of it, contact our staff. We can get you a copy or show you where to get it.
It is on the web. They're on that sheet I handed out, you can dial in at the website at Morris.
Great. Thank you. All right. If there's no other business, the committee is adjourned.